Broadcasting on the Drug Truth Network, it's the Cultural Baggage Show, the unvarnished truth about the drug war. My name is Dean Becker. Steve Nolan is our engineer. And in just a few moments, we'll bring in our main guest for this evening, Frank Levine. He's the managing editor of Extra newspaper in San Antonio. It's a Spanish-English bilingual paper. And after our break, we'll hear from Dr. Rick Doblin regarding a lawsuit filed today against the federal government to allow scientists to conduct new studies of medical marijuana. But first, let's hear our Poppygate, which is track 10.
Poppygate, bizarre news about the U.S. policy on controlling heroin, featuring Glenn Greenway.
1.7 million Afghanis are now dependent on poppy cultivation for their livelihoods. Opium producers in Afghanistan have secured a heroin consumer base of two-thirds of all heroin users in the world. The most recent UN report on AIDS states that the HIV/AIDS epidemics in Central Asia and Eastern Europe are being driven by intravenous drug users. Horrifyingly, the number of those infected in this region has doubled since 1995. On June 11, 2004, the UK's Sunday Mirror announced that the street price of heroin has dropped by 250% in the last 10 years. In 2003, Butler County, Pennsylvania, Chief Detective Pat Cannon announced that heroin remains our biggest problem and added that 75 to 80% of the people in the local jail are there because of heroin. In 2000, there were 47 overdoses reported at the local hospital. By 2002, that had increased to 170. And finally, in Iowa on Friday, a couple was arrested for growing 22,000 opium poppy plants. Too bad they didn't live in Afghanistan. This is Glenn Greenway reporting for the Drug Truth Network.
I want to thank Glenn for that fine report. Now here's today's editorial. Most of all, the U.S. has a drug prohibition problem. Drugs have been around for millennia. Why some suddenly think it's their moral obligation to stop the rest of us from using is truly beyond. What we have is an addicted population that loves the drug war. Politicians, policemen, urine testers, doctors, lawyers, the list goes on for as long as we allow it. They are addicts, all. All these people serve as brujos, charlatans, witch doctors, shills, frontmen, and as paid liars to support each other's occupations and their own. Asking anyone who stands behind a bully pulpit if his job is superfluous is like asking your barber if you need a touch-up. Big Brother has taken the role of conscience, guardian, judge, and jury on every aspect of our lives, and a loud minority thinks that's a good idea and will lie, deceive, and kill to maintain their position. We bribe people all over the world to protect us from ourselves. Now, having said that, I want to bring in our guest for the evening. As I said, his name is Frank Levine. He's the managing editor of the Extra newspaper in San Antonio. Can you hear me, Frank?
Yes, I can. How are you doing?
Welcome, sir. Welcome to Cultural Baggage. Frank, we've talked briefly in the past week or so about your job and reporting the news both on this side and the other side of the Mexican border. You want to tell us about your experiences south of the border?
Well, let me give you a little bit of background. I first went into Mexico in the very early 1970s under the government of Luis Echeverria. And I got a job after working as a reporter at the Mexico City News. I worked there for a few years and then went to Puerto Rico, worked at the San Juan Star as assistant city editor. Eventually wound up back in Mexico as city editor of the Mexico City News. I did a brief stint with AP, Associated Press in Mexico. I worked for other publications, Mexican publications, including El Sol, Novedades, La Jornada. And in 1982, I went down to as a correspondent for the News in Guatemala and El Salvador and covered the war down there for a while. Upon my return, I went back to the News as city editor. I worked as a reporter at the San Antonio Light before it became Express News, and also worked as briefly as city editor of the Laredo Morning Times.
Wow, I didn't know you had that much experience. We should have talked more. Thank you for outlining that for us. So that does give you a diverse set of experience, a diverse look at this drug war. Tell us your synopsis. Where are we at with this drug war now?
Well, you know, I don't think we're winning the war, that's for sure. I mean, if there is a war to be won, as long as that demand remains here, and as long as people want to make money, and as long as there's corruption on both sides of the border, this will be a never-ending struggle. And just that I've been fortunate to meet players on both sides. If you talk whether it be the Colombians or people moving product up through Mexico, for most of them it's primarily an economic venture. Many years ago when I first went into Mexico, I mean, there always was some level of drug use, but most of the people didn't use the product they were shipping up here. You know, it was just purely economic for most people involved in the trade.
Yes, sir. Go ahead.
Yes, no, continue on. I'm sorry.
Well, no, that's okay. I was kind of curious that, do you not perhaps see a bit of that same economic scenario creeping across the border, becoming part of our potential problems on this side as well now?
Oh, absolutely. You know, and the level of by the way, as a little side note, I went down to Guadalajara and covered the death of Kiki Camarena, the DEA agent who was killed in Guadalajara, I had access to what the DEA at the time used to call DE-6s, and they were basically like an interrogation report. And I also had access to my other contacts in Mexico to the original interrogation reports that were done before they were redacted by intelligence agencies and law enforcement on both sides of the border. The revelations are stunning. Okay, what we see is people on both sides of the border, military, police, political officials, looking the other way while huge, huge convoys of, in this case happened to be marijuana, were flowing up to the border. We had one DE-6 and one interrogation report that was later confirmed that Caro Quintero, one of the one of the people accused and eventually convicted for the murder of Kiki Camarena among a number of others, went up to San Diego and over a very short period of time allegedly purchased 200 pickup trucks for cash. Not one person, not one car dealer, not one bank, no one bothered to report it to the U.S. government or to the banking commission or the feds or anything. In other words, as long as the money was good, nobody raised any questions. So the corruption extended well beyond the border. Well, I don't want to go into all the details, but I have information, I'm sure it's publicly available, of people in the high-ranking field-grade military officers that have been quietly arrested along the Texas border for smuggling drugs, cocaine included, in the United States. They're fired, I mean, just retired. You don't see them doing any time. And I mean, it's just completely and utterly stunning, the magnitude. You know, if you go on the street right now, and by the way, I my office is in Austin, not in San Antonio. I just want to make that point. But
okay, I didn't know that.
But you know, just on the street, you know, there's so much on the street right now. The price is so low in terms of for pot and for other drugs, you know, that it's obvious, it was just a real supply and demand market. It's obviously that the war on drugs has failed. And I just wanted to let you know that in 1992, I was on assignment for the San Antonio Light, and I flew down to Guerrero, the state of Guerrero, to participate in a federal judicial police raid on a little village that was known as a drug village and report on the alleged progress of the Mexican government to gain certification by the U.S. government in the war against drugs. When I went down there, we flew out of Chilpancingo to a little town called La Venta. Now, La Venta is on the top of a little mountain, and it was just a scene out of Apocalypse Now. We're flying in with helicopters, military, federal judicial police, all with M-16s, heavily armed. And as they're flying into these valleys, I'm noticing that everything is red, all as far as you can see. Well, that red represented seeds of poppy, of opium poppies. that were growing unhindered. So, you know, I asked one of the commandantes, I said, you know, why are you letting these puppies, you know, grow? He said, we just don't have the resources to eliminate them, and if we do one, and, you know, of course, you said, you know, within a few months that they'll be back again, there's nothing very little we can do. So when finally reached La Venta, the little tiny, tiny village, you know, on top of this mountain, little thatched huts with satellite antennas, and I go up there, and I finally follow up. I am a little bit older than most of these young soldiers, so it took me a couple of minutes to climb up the hill. But while I was climbing up the hill to the mountain, I noticed on the other side of the mountain there were five mules going down, pack mules going down with old men leading them with huge, huge bales on their backs. And being that this was an opium or poppy area, you know, I just, you know, I turned and I said, why don't you guys, you know, check out those people just out of curiosity. And he said, no, that's their life, they're old men, don't worry about them. So we drove up to the top of the mountain, and, you know, they burned down some little the little houses, and they roused some people and this and that. And they turned up about a ton of marijuana, which they burned for me as a photo opportunity or as a photo shoot. And as we were leaving, you know, they began loading probably 400 or 500 pounds of marijuana on the helicopters. And I said, what are you guys doing? You know, in terms of they took boxes, and they filled up with marijuana in boxes. These were Mexican federal judicial police, as well as some military. Oh, we're taking it back to Chilpancingo for laboratory analysis, they told me. But apart from that, but then you begin to realize how what was happening. Those five men who went down on the other side of the hill, that was the real value. That was opium, gum of opium, or heroin, or Mexican brown heroin, that was worth 100 times more than all the pot that they burned for the show through the American press as well as through their own. You know, but I'm just saying, it's so institutionalized. This goes all the way back to the 1940s. You know, I'm sure you're aware that during World War II, we needed huge amounts of morphine, you know, to supply our soldiers. And I don't know if you discussed this with your listeners before, but we asked Mexico to produce poppies, opium poppies, in large quantities. And at the end of the war, like we've done so many other places around the world, we just pulled the plug on them and said, okay, well, too bad. War's over, we don't need your product anymore, and you're people that were used to having a steady income where they never had one before. Large landowners were making millions of dollars for the in those days, the Department of War that was and the U.S. government that was purchasing huge quantities of opium derivatives from Mexico. Well, when they pulled the plug, okay, then began the underground, part of that underground empire, if you will. And involved at the time, and this is based on interviews that I conducted with Jaime Plan, an old El Paso Times reporter, who later became editor of the Mexico City News, and his documentation, especially during the early 1950s, was astounding. You know, he reported, and of course there have always been rumors about presidential and high government officials' involvement in terms of the drug trade, from Mexico in particular, but no one had ever been able to draw the link. What had occurred was evidently, and you know, it almost went into almost an urban legend, but there was indication that the story is true, that one of the pilots from a former president, Miguel Alemán of Mexico, had crashed in northern Mexico with opium on board, and evidently he fled the scene, and the opium was eventually distributed in the town, and it caused a serious incident. That pilot, I'd rather not mention his name right now, but we can develop, that pilot later became very prominent in Texas and a big, very important businessman in the San Antonio area, and a man with access to presidents, easy telephone access to presidents throughout the 50s, 60s, and 70s, with the possible exception of Dwight Eisenhower, until just very recently. And the reality of it is, when Miguel Alemán, a very large landowner, realized that he was not going to make any money, then he began producing opium. Everything had remained relatively stable until probably the early 1960s, Capitol Inn where that famous French Connection came down in New York, and for briefly they stopped the traditional heroin trade coming out of Turkey. Well, you had a lot of people that were out of work, and there was a lot of people, some of them Cuban exiles, some of them linked to, at that time, if you recall, the mafia was allegedly involved with assassination plots against Fidel Castro. And so what the organized crime did is utilize people with access to Cuba or former Cuban exiles to move some of the product, you know, as a sideline to their plots against Fidel Castro. Well, in any event, one of these men was a gentleman named Falcon, who was recruited by the CIA in Miami. And Falcon was playing both sides. He was moving drugs, very much like our friend Mr. Noriega, who is now in federal prison. He was playing both sides. He was moving drugs and at the same time was following CIA and organized crime orders to assassinate Fidel Castro. He failed miserably. And once the French Connection came down, he couldn't move heroin anymore. He wound up in Spain. And in Spain, by coincidence, he was in the same hotel with a number of Colombians. And these Colombians, these people seek out one another. And they said, hey, listen, Falcon said, I'm out of work. Can you have anything for me? And so we have product. We have cocaine. Let's move it. And he said, well, I have a lot of contacts in Mexico because Mexico was one of the staging areas in Guatemala. We're one of the staging areas of anti-Castro as well as Puerto Rico activity. And he said, I have a lot of friends in Mexico, and maybe we can use Guadalajara, as they want to call it in Spanish, the trampolín, to bring heroin into, to bring cocaine into the United States, which is a new level, a new product, not new, but certainly gained a larger market share in the U.S. market. But a lot of people didn't really know what cocaine was at that time. I mean, you know, young people who had used heroin. There was always a very hardcore heroin use in the United States, but there weren't, and the numbers were high. But the addiction was relatively solidified through the 30s, 40s, 50s, and early 60s. When cocaine first began coming in, Falcon and people Falcon and Camarena and Fonseca and all these guys began using Guadalajara as a jumping off point to bring some of this product in the United States. And one way that they stimulated the market was in every kilo of cocaine, of marijuana that they moved, they put a little sample packet of cocaine in as like a test, like a little tester. You know, so in every one of those packets, they put a little tiny packet of cocaine in, and basically, it's been continuing ever since. I mean, they blocked some. Look at this way. Quite often, I can give you instances that I've reported on, that I've interviewed the DEA on.
Frank, let me interrupt you, sir. We are quickly running out of time. I do have another segment I want to do. First off, I want to tell you, we're going to have to bring you back. This is very in depth. Very interesting stuff, and I appreciate you taking time to visit with us.
I
was enjoying every moment of it. It's very profound stuff, and as I say, let's do bring you back. I wanted to just point out that you have also written some things in regards to medical marijuana. I believe in the
San Marcos
Daily Record, and that's what we're going to do. We're going to talk to Dr. Rick Doblin about a lawsuit they filed today. And again, sir, you have so much knowledge. I do want to invite you back for later this summer, if you will.
Oh, absolutely, and hopefully I'll be. I'm getting older now, so the names sometimes are beginning to fade, but I'll rewrite them down. And I mean, I know the names, the last names or whatever, but names and dates they're beginning to fade because I hadn't written about that specific area in a few years.
No, sir. It's very strong stuff, and I hope my audience, I'm sure my audience is enjoying it. It's wonderful to hear the truth coming from a newspaper man, a guy who had his feet on the ground, his boots on the ground, and a guy who saw this up firsthand.
You know, the thing about it, just one little point, and that is this. You know, there are newspaper guys, and there are newspaper guys. They're newspaper guys who go out, and whichever the way the wind blows, that's the way they'll blow.
Frank, real quick, if you would, give the folks your y'all's website so they can go learn more about you and your paper.
Okay, well, my paper can be reached at naustin, naustin.com, and the name of the paper is Extra, E-X-T-R-A. We're coming out with an edition tomorrow. It's we write both in Spanish and in English, trying to open the awareness here within our Hispanic community because of generally the media being somewhat controlled, you know, so we want them to have access to information that is not readily available in traditional Spanish media direct or media directed to the Hispanic community, and that's basically what we're doing.
Thank you, Frank. Levine, he's the managing editor with Extra Newspaper. Let's take that break, Steve.
This is Dean Becker on behalf of the Drug Truth Network urging you to get registered to vote. Vote early, vote often, vote absentee so it can be counted again. It's time to play Name That Drug by its Side Effects. Prolonged bleeding, wheezing, breathlessness, ringing in the ears, hearing loss, chronic runny nose, headache, confusion, nausea, vomiting, ulcers, rash, allergic reactions, hives, bruising, abnormal liver function, hepatitis, kidney damage, metabolic derangements, strokes, fatal hemorrhages of the brain, spleen, liver, intestines, and lungs, and death. Time's up. The answer, aspirin, another FDA-approved product. If you would like to get a CD copy of this or any of our programs featuring judges, scientists, doctors, lawyers, people from all over the world to share with Redneck Uncle Bubba, please visit unvarnishedtruth.org. Once again, the ever-changing yet never-changing drug policy of U.S. officials is truly, obviously, and once again, reefer madness. I received a press release from the Marijuana Policy Project in regards to a suit where scientists are suing the federal government for blocking medical marijuana research.
I'm Rick Doblin, Ph.D., founder and president of the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, or MAPS, www.maps.org. And while it sounds like we're just interested in psychedelics, we're actually a nonprofit pharmaceutical company, in a sense, that's trying to develop psychedelics and marijuana into FDA-approved prescription medicines. We believe in science. We believe that rather than medicines being determined by politics, which mostly means medicines being prevented from becoming medicines by the drug war, that we should let scientific research and the FDA evaluate what we believe to be true, which is that there are significant benefits from these substances in terms of medicine. Also, we believe in terms of other personal growth, spirituality, things like that. But right now we're focusing on medicine, and that we think that scientific research will show that the risk can be outweighed by the benefits when you balance it out, and that we just want to do the research. So the suit is that we actually have been having a tremendous difficulty getting marijuana from the government to do research with. Right now the government has a monopoly on the supply of marijuana that can be used in research. They don't have a monopoly on anything else, on LSD, on MDMA. MAPS has its own supply of MDMA, its own supply of psilocybin. And so we have research going with psilocybin and with MDMA. But the government has a monopoly on the supply of marijuana held by the National Institute of Drug Abuse. And the National Institute on Drug Abuse, their mission is not to develop the medical use of marijuana. Their mission is to scare people into why marijuana is so bad that, you know, we got to throw all these people in jail because of it. So trying to get marijuana from NIDA is difficult. And so our lawsuit is that we have applied for 3 years in association with Professor Lyle Craker at UMass Amherst. He's the director of the Medicinal Plant Program, the Department of Plant and Soil Sciences. We've applied for permission to set up our own production facility. In over 3 years, DEA has not said yes or no. The first year, they pretended to have lost the application. We've applied. We're also doing research with vaporizers. Vaporizers heat marijuana up, but they don't burn it. And you get a vapor stream that doesn't have the combustion product. So we believe that high-potency marijuana used through vaporizer can probably make it through the FDA and be declared safe and efficacious for certain medical conditions. So we've applied with a lab that we're working with to do the vaporizer research, has applied to import 10 grams from the Dutch Office of Medicinal Cannabis. Following all international treaty obligations, they can export marijuana. But we have to get an import permit from the DEA. So we've applied over a year ago for 10 grams from the Dutch office for the vaporizer research, and DEA has not processed the application. They're supposed to file in the Federal Register. They haven't done that. And also, the same lab has applied to NIDA for 10 grams to purchase NIDA's low-potency material for the vaporizer research. And they submitted the protocol. NIDA is supposed to review the protocol for scientific merit, and then if so, they let you purchase marijuana. So we haven't heard from NIDA in over a year. So we are blocked from growing our own, importing, or even purchasing any from the monopoly supply of the government. So we have active government obstruction of medical marijuana research at the same time that the government is saying that all these state initiatives and medical marijuana, that marijuana is not a medicine because it hasn't been proven so by the FDA. We need more research. You know, we want to squash all these states that are trying to let patients have access to marijuana because we need more research. And at the same time, the government is blocking research. So it's a completely hypocritical situation. And what we're trying to do with this lawsuit is we're alleging unreasonable delay according to the Administrative Procedures Act and hoping that we can get the courts to force the government to say yes or no. If they want to say yes, we'd be happier because then we start medical marijuana research. But if they say no, then we sue them about that. And then at least we have exposed the fact that this government is not trying to facilitate medical marijuana research. They're trying to block it.
I think it's totally apropos that this suit is filed on the same day. I was mad this morning reading the Houston Chronicle headlines. Stronger pot makes reefer madness real.
US. Oh, that's so bogus.
That's circulated by Reuters about Walters and his bogus lies. You're absolutely right.
Right. I mean, what they admit from those kind of studies is the fact that there's always been strong pot around, and it's safer because you need to smoke less, and that experienced smokers will smoke less. And then also the numbers of kids that are supposedly going into treatment because of marijuana, which is what they use as their evidence that this is a new marijuana, it's terribly dangerous. What's incredible is that according to the government's own statistics, most of the people in that age group that go into treatment are forced there. They're not, you know, addicts in any way at all. They're forced there, discovered by schools or parents, whatever. Some of them may have problems, but they're not this, you know, horrible marijuana addicts. But the government's own statistics show that over half of them have only used marijuana three times or less in the month before they went into treatment. 30% of them have not used marijuana at all in the month before treatment. So what kind of treatment is this? This is treatment for behavior problems. This is treatment for rebellion. This is not treatment for marijuana. This is not an example of, you know, marijuana being more potent and therefore more dangerous.
Okay, those in power, those who support the drug war with their knowing lies, are monsters, knowing purveyors of death and misery, drug lords in every respect. That includes politicians, police, piss testers, and scientists with an axe to grind and a check to cash. Well over a million lie on a daily basis to meet their mortgage payments. Prohibition makes felons of over 85 million harmless, productive citizens who have tried marijuana. Prohibition turns violent criminals loose on the streets for lack of prison space. Prohibition destroys families with forfeiture and mandatory licenses lost. Prohibition cheapens and in many cases erases our rights as Americans, especially privacy and personal liberty. Well, as always, as it's ending, I must remind you, because of drug prohibition, you don't know what's in that bag. Please be careful.
For the Drug Truth Network, and on behalf of my technical producer, Steve Nolan, this is Dean Becker for Cultural Baggage, the unvarnished truth. This show is produced at the Pacifica Studios of KPFT, Houston.
Tap dancing on the edge of cannabis.